Welcome to Two Way Street. This month, Beverly Guitar Watkins will turn 78 years old. Her name may not ring a bell for you, which is probably why a magazine writer once called her the greatest living blues guitarist that no one has ever heard of. Beverly's entire life has been devoted to playing the blues. She grew up in Commerce, Georgia, and began taking the guitar seriously in high school. By the 1960s, she was playing backup on records that were embraced by young white artists who wanted to play rock and roll more than anything in the world. On tours in the U.S. and Europe, she played on the same bill with legends like James Brown and Ray Charles. She never got rich playing the blues, but she never stopped playing. And to this day, Beverly has a following, especially here in Atlanta, where she still makes her home. I thought about Beverly this week because it was just about 1 year ago that producer Jenny Amont and I were invited to watch her celebrate her 77th birthday by playing a show at Northside Tavern, an Atlanta dive bar that's a spiritual home for blues lovers. She was still holding her own with players half her age that night and still executing one of her favorite stage tricks, playing riffs on her guitar while holding it backward and over her head. And so, as Beverly Watkins gets set to celebrate another birthday, it seemed like a good time to share with you a show we recorded with her last April when she brought her old battered guitar to the Two Way Street Studios. She started by telling us a story about her early life. She remembered being a little girl, sitting and listening as her sharecropper grandfather played fiddle and invited the family to join in singing gospel songs in the evening after work in the fields was finished. And then one day, she was presented with an instrument of her own.
And my Aunt Margaret, which is deceased now, she gave me a little old guitar called the Stella. I had no idea that that was a gift from God to me, you know, as playing a guitar.
So you were 8 years old. You got this little guitar as a gift. And then the blues. Yes?
And then here come the blues. And the first song I learned to play was Blue Suede Shoes.
Can you still play it?
Yes.
You have your guitar. Do you want to play a little of it for us?
I can.
All right, let's do it.
One for the money, two for the show, three make ready, let's go, cat, go. Now don't step on my blue suede shoe. Yeah, you can do anything, step on my blue suede shoe. Out my hat, break my shoes. I said, don't step on my blue suede shoe. I can tell you people don't step on my blue suede shoe. I said blue suede shoes. Oh, you can do anything, don't step on my blue suede shoes. Oh, yeah.
Wow, Beverly Watkins' first song. Blue Suede Shoes. That wasn't Elvis's song at first, was it?
No, someone else wrote that.
Yeah.
Before Elvis.
Yeah, I thought so. And it was the blues that really captivated you. Why?
The blues, because I guess that was, I was born with the blues in me.
What are some basic blues chords? I mean, there's a fairly simple and straightforward blues progression, right? That you
yes.
learn initially, which is what?
Yes, okay. Like I play in G, G7.
You want to show us while you're telling us?
Okay, all right, can do.
Thank you.
I'm going to do a slow blues.
Okay.
Blues chord, G7. A C7, yeah.
Oh, I got the blues. I'm singing about the blues.
Yeah. Then you go to the D. You know the blues. Well, blues is all right for you. Well, D, I want to tell you people, I'm gonna play the blues for you.
That's wonderful. So there you go.
Yes, after I finished high school, I went right as a senior, and I finished Archie. I went on the road playing rhythm guitar with Piano Red.
You were a bass player when you started, is that right?
Yes.
Why didn't that take?
Well, I said like this here. We all have gifts, and they don't come overnight. Whenever the Lord gets ready to reveal that gift to you, because back when I played with Piano Red as rhythm, I didn't sing. I didn't do any vocals. All I did was up there, stand up there and look pretty and played rhythm.
But yeah. You were born, God made you to be a lead guitar player.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, you know, this is what he wanted me to be, to do.
There are many people who think in some ways Piano Red really kind of led the way for rock and roll to develop because
yes.
of the way he played, right?
Yes, he did, with his style. Yes, sir.
Let's listen to the song that you performed on this record we're about to hear a little bit of.
Okay.
It was Piano Red, and it became one of the most famous songs that you all would perform, Mr. Moonlight.
Yes.
Mr. Yes. Moonlight. You came to me.
Who is that singing lead?
That's Roy Lee. And Curtis is, that's Curtis doing the second part. It was three of us.
That's a great song.
Wow.
The Beatles recorded that song, made it famous, yes?
Yes, they did.
Wow.
When we went and did Dr. Feelgood, Dr. Feelgood, that CD went platinum, and then that's when we start going out of the state.
What was one of the tracks on Dr. Feelgood that you remember that you particularly liked?
Oh, I liked Rice String Baby, but the wrong yo-yo.
You know,
I do that now.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because mm-hmm. that was one of Piano Red's signature songs, but it's kind of become a signature song for you. Would you share a little of it with us?
I sure will. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. You got the right string, baby, for my yo-yo. Somebody's knocking on your door. Pass by the store, put the string on wrong. String for my yo-yo. Hey! Mama told me, and Papa did too. Some of those men's gonna make a fool of you. Better find out which one you pray. Right string, baby, for my yo-yo.
That's Beverly Guitar Watkins. You got the right string, baby, but the wrong yo-yo. You couldn't make a living as a musician, as an artist for a long time, could you?
It was a long time, yes it was.
How did you make your living when you were already playing with Piano Red and mm-hmm. out there doing really wonderful things, but how did you make your living?
Well, back in 78, 79, the band broke up. Our group broke up and everybody went their ways. But I never stopped playing. What happened was, I got a job washing cars, but I played on the weekend here in Atlanta. What happened? I joined up with Mr. Eddie Tigner, which he is 90 years old now, one of the original Ink Spots.
Wow.
And I went out with him and played bass. We would go to like some of the big motels, Holiday Inns, and we probably would stay there probably a week, 2 weeks, you know, playing in the lounges. When I come back in town, then it rocked on. Then I got jobs cleaning houses. Then after that, then I start cleaning offices, but I never stopped playing.
You had a platinum album you talked about, but
yes.
But you didn't see much come your way as a result of that, did you?
No, I didn't.
What happened?
It was divided before it got to me, you know.
That must have hurt.
It really did. It really did. Now I'm getting a little royalties, but maybe not what I should get. But what I didn't get back then, I'm still going to get.
It was in 1999 when your CD came out. Mm-hmm. It was that CD that put you back on the map. Isn't that right? The title of the CD was Back in Business. And
yes.
Here's the title track.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure we got a little bit of you playing that guitar.
No. Mm-hmm.
Back in Business.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that song?
Sure.
Why don't you play it? Would you mind playing a little live for us?
Back in business. Back in business. Well, I'm back in business. Well, I'm back in business. Well, I'm back in business. Jumping to the very end. Oh, yeah.
Beverly Watkins, Back in Business. What did that CD do for you in your career?
Oh, it carried me many places. It really did.
Where?
We went to Paris, France. We went to Germany, Argentina. I can just go on and go on, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it really brought me out, really did.
Could you start making a living as a blues artist at that point?
Yes.
That's good.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
You want to play us out? What do you want to play? What's a favorite?
Well, maybe I will do this gospel.
Oh, I love that idea.
This is about the Lord will make a way somehow. I know the Lord, He'll make a way. Yes, He will. I know the Lord, He'll make a way. Yes, He will. That's the truth, y'all. You can go to Him in secret prayer. Yes, and I know that He can answer your prayer. I know the Lord, He'll make a way. Yes, He will. Yes, He will. Jesse Weed. Jesse Weed. I have a savior. I can carry my troubles too. And I don't know why.
That's Beverly Guitar Watkins, the Atlanta blues artist who's traveled the world playing with some of the greatest names in R&B and blues, Ray Charles, B.B. King, James Brown, and others. If you check out the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS, you can watch a younger Beverly Watkins in a live performance. We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, who are the people who spray paint colorful graphics on underpasses, freight trains, and walls all over cities like Atlanta? Why do they do it? And is their graffiti art? This is Two-Way Street. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. When Dax Redknack first came into the Two-Way Street studio, his visit made me realize there are far too many moments in my life when I look but really don't see. As I drive and walk through Atlanta, I pass walls covered with graffiti, see it on bridges and freight trains and so many other outdoor spaces. But I've really never stopped to see it, let alone thought much about who put it there and why. Well, one of the people who puts it there is Dax Redknack, or as he's known in the world of graffiti writers, where he's a genuine star, Dr. Dax. He started his spray painting adventures when he was a teenager growing up in Atlanta. But like the street artists of New York, who began as vandals and ended up becoming the darlings of the art elite, Dr. Dax can now fetch up to five figures for one of his spray-painted canvases. Dax came into the Two-Way Street studio last May to talk about his career in graffiti and to tell us about the fascinating culture that surrounds the graffiti writers. Obviously, people talk about painting graffiti sometimes, but more frequently, we talk about writing.
Writing, yes.
Which is interesting to me because writing is different from art, doing something artistic in
my mind.
It's a different word entirely.
And writers, too, they look at a lot of stuff that people do that you might see not even as the writing culture. They call it spray can art or street art. And, you know, there's a million labels that come along now, but writers definitely like to always be considered a writer,
right,
not a vandal necessarily. Even the word graffiti, a lot of writers don't even like to be called graffiti writers because they say that graffiti's unwanted markings. And a lot of people like to think of their stuff as being wanted, whether with permission or not.
Okay, but I'm asking a different question. Given the choice between calling yourself an artist and a writer, most of the people who do graffiti prefer to be called writers.
That's
why?
Right. I think maybe a lot of people like to be considered writers too because we didn't look at it as like an art form that we learned these techniques and all this stuff. It was just pretty much straightforward writing your name.
So you started paying attention to graffiti as a teenager here in Atlanta, right?
So what caught my interest the most was riding MARTA and seeing the graffiti out the window. It was very mysterious and very mischievous. And as a kid, it was almost like, to me, my first spark of seeing like maybe a comic book hero or something. These people seemed to me like superhero types. They're very mysterious, didn't know who they were, didn't know how to figure out who they were and how they did what they did or even got to where they got.
Like, was really it exciting. On the sides of buildings?
Yeah, it was on the rooftops and sides of buildings. Looking out the window of the MARTA train, you know, going from stop to stop, and then I would switch around just to go back and look at everything and then have to go back the other way to look at the other side of the train windows. And there was a good bit of it here at that time. So ever since then, I've been really excited about public art.
I've read that a book that made a real impact on you was Subway Art. You found a copy of Subway Art by Martha Cooper and Henry Chalfant, right?
That's correct.
Two photographers.
That's my Bible.
They were two photographers in New York who began separately documenting graffiti, mostly on the subway trains of New York. And this book was published, I think, in like 1986. And we all remember, I think, back in those days, New York subways were just covered with graffiti, right?
That's correct.
Why did that book matter to you so much?
Well, when I moved to Atlanta, the graffiti here was still very in its early stages, which I would compare to New York's probably late 60s or, you know, the very beginning of the 70s. And that's pretty much where we were with graffiti. When I saw the book Subway Art, I'd seen something way more advanced and way more futuristic. It seemed like many generations have passed, lots of traditions and things have been set in stone. So I figured that out immediately reading that book. That's why I call it a Bible. It was definitely like some sort of handbook to life and the lifestyle of graffiti. You know, even the lingo, that book really broke it down. And then seeing it on moving objects changed the things. Like being in Atlanta, seeing graffiti from a moving object to seeing it on moving objects in the book blew my mind.
Yeah.
And so that even took it way further. I became obsessed since then. I wasn't even able to learn in school because I was always drawing graffiti.
How did it make you feel as you watched the city of New York go to war against the graffiti artists who the establishment in New York felt were defacing public property, that sort of thing?
Man, I mean, it's like Style Wars is a documentary that was made by Henry Chalfant, which was part of Subway Art, but they interview Koch, which was the mayor at the time.
Yep.
Yeah, they are interviewing him. They were showing him some of my favorite writers and whole car pieces that were in the book. They were showing him, I think, some of the pages from Subway Art. And they're like, you know, like, how can you say that's vandalism? He's like, oh, those are exceptional. The problem is the millions of people who try to replicate that. And that probably stands true in any city for anybody. You know, I probably, for everything good I do and pieces that I've spent my whole life developing and people they love, there's probably about 100 kids that try to mimic what I do and don't really understand it all the way. So some of the mess, you know, probably is spawned off of what we do. I think it's the same thing with how New York was. People started wanting to be Dondi and, you know, Is the Wiz and Zephyrs and all those guys and started seeing that stuff rolling by and we're like, I'm going to take a lick at it too. You know, everybody was taking a lick at it. And I think it became such a part of New York culture. I mean, you go to New York and every single person, even if they're a real serious about it or not, they have a tag name probably or whatever. It's just every kid in New York, even young girls all the way through the late 70s, 80s, 90s till now, have a hand style, have a name, a graffiti name,
whether they pursue it or not. Reel off some of those names. They're great names.
All right. Just from the 70s, my favorites?
Well, from any period.
Yeah, like Super Cool 223, Stay High 149, Cool Disco Dan from D.C. Guys from here were like Sir Leon and Sir Smith. Those are the types of names going on in Atlanta.
When you started, had you done graffiti before that book? In other words, after riding MARTA and seeing buildings, had you already started doing some graffiti of your own?
Yeah, I started when I came to Atlanta. I created a tag at the time, which I just wrote TR. And when I moved to Atlanta, I just immediately off the airplane just came and started writing it with my little Sharpies and started finding spray paint, stealing spray paint from my father. I just started writing it everywhere.
What did TR stand for?
At the time, it stood for totally ridiculous. And, you know, I went into had many, many names after that.
What's the impulse behind that? You would find buildings all over town, wherever you were.
Yes.
And you would put TR, you'd spray paint it on the side of the building.
Yes.
What's the impulse?
It's pretty hard to explain, but I think overall as a child, I mean, I guess maybe even just the fact that you know other people will see it, there's something in that. I think it goes back in time. People have always wanted to leave their mark of some sort or leave some sort of communication. And that even goes along with, you know, just to write TR and maybe write some sort of a clever quote next to it, you know, like you just even was here. TR was here. And after a while, you know, when I would write it in front of my friends, they'd be like, oh, that's you. And it just kind of starts building from there. It becomes some sort of a drug, you know, a high. And then, you know, moving on to moving objects, it just goes way out of control. Like a friend of mine by the name of SB1 used to tell me to write on walls is natural, but to write on trains is divine. And that always stuck with me, and I think that's true.
It's interesting because do you know who Kilroy was?
I didn't know him personally, but I think he was like a World War II came out of some sort of political statements or something.
Kilroy was here.
Kilroy
became
was here.
A ubiquitous little drawing.
Little guy with the big nose.
With a big nose that popped up all over Europe in the European theater during World War II. I suppose, I never thought of it before, Kilroy was kind of the first graffiti artist.
Well, they say that, yeah. They say, like, as far there's different levels to that, because they say, like, the first guy who really started tagging his name on freight trains was J.B. King Esquire. He was tagging trains at the, you know, doing monikers with oil bars on the freight trains in the turn of the century, and he has a beautiful one line J.B. King Esquire that's circled. It's a very fancy signature, which most people said he must have went to a pretty damn good school, and that his father possibly even owned some of the train lines. And that's why his signature was so beautiful. You can look up pictures of it. But he definitely struck up, you know, what would become, you know, hobo monikers and folk art on freight trains from the 1900s all the way till now. Something that really stuck around. A lot of train workers, a lot of people started doing. So a lot of people even thought subway art in New York was probably the first of its kind, but it wasn't. The freight train monikers were the first as far as moving objects go. But then you can trace writing on walls back all the way to the pyramids and, you know, pharaohs and all that stuff. So
yeah.
I think it's just always been human nature to
put your mark,
but make it the more noticeable it can be, the better of a place it is.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more with Dr. Dax. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dax Redneck, or Dr. Dax. He's one of the most celebrated graffiti writers in the Southeast. One of the things you're known for here in Atlanta is you looked at the subway art that you saw in New York, and you decided that you ought to transfer that to freight trains.
That's right.
How did that happen?
Well, living in Atlanta, which was the main hub of freight trains and connecting all the North American train lines to the South. This is like a, you know, even till this day, with all the industries that have shut down and all the lines that have been shut down, there's still huge train yards here. A lot of trains still come here to be separated and sent off into their final destinations or whatever, or the other way around. And growing up here, and it seemed this, I mean, the second I saw subway art, I was like, oh man, there's trains right in my backyard. You know, there's trains everywhere. Everywhere I hang out, there's always trains. So I instantly went and started painting on them. And maybe that was a direct result of reading subway art, but I'd already like caught maybe a couple tags on them. And then when I saw that book, I really just went crazy on that too. And that led into meeting some of the greatest people I've ever known.
All right, you decided to start writing on freight trains.
That's right.
Were you writing on moving freight trains? How do you go about it? What is the stealth activity that's involved in being able to do what is essentially illegal vandalism?
Yeah, well, you know, there's definitely different levels of ways to get away with that. I won't go too deep into it, just for the kids who still, you know, keep that a secret. But just for the, I never ride on moving ones. I used to always stay away from moving trains. I don't care how dumb you are. When you get near those things, they're so huge and powerful and like monsters rolling by. They're loud. You know they're not nothing to mess with. At least I did always, so I always used to just try to find a nice one that doesn't seem like it's going to move anytime soon, which I learned the hard way, too, that, you know, start painting something and start working on it, making something nice, and the thing pulls off. But there's definitely ways of finding ones that aren't going to move, and you just got to do your research and studying and figure it out.
Is this stuff that happens in the middle of the night? Is it having to go into a train yard somewhere where
Yards sometimes are the worst places to go because they're so busy, you know, and that's where they're active. Trying to find a non-active one in a hidden spot. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the middle of the night. When I was younger, I used to be pretty dumb. I used to actually go around 6 a.m. just because I wasn't allowed to stay out all night all the time. But my dad would let me get up as early as I wanted to venture out. I was always liked getting up at the crack of dawn just to try to make the most of all my summer days, especially. You know, I knew a couple places where trains just sat there, sitting there, and I think they were empties. So I even figured out that time, like, that nobody probably really cared about them. And I was seeing the monikers, which were done by people who were not graffiti writers.
Monikers are?
Monikers being done with, they're always done with oil bars, which I think maybe was like some sort of.
What does that mean, an oil bar?
An oil bar, it's not a thing for art, but they do sell things like that in art. I think they would be called
They're like crayons. They're crayon, yeah, but with an oil base.
Kind of like what they write on your
color.
Windshield with when you get your car towed. I think it's something that the rail system started providing for their workers.
And you would put, and you said that you use an oil bar to put your moniker.
And a moniker would be, what's his name, like the Colossus of Rhodes, the Rambler of Beaumont, Texas, you know, or some Bozo, Texas, you know, a bunch of like very, very Americana.
What's your moniker?
I didn't have a moniker. I was a graffiti writer. So there's a difference, you know?
Okay, the monikers, I understand. Now you caught, okay, now I'm lost. Right,
yeah.
What's the
monikers
difference?
Would be like J.B. King Esquire, the guy in the 1900s. You know, those guys who started writing their names and dating them. They'd write them with a date. Now then they started incorporating some sort of an imagery.
Okay.
You know, like the solo artist draws the mountains with the guy with the glasses looking into the mountains, the little river stream and the train tracks wrapping around.
Okay.
So monikers are, you know, a lot of hobos did them. There was always a hobos or rail workers. Anybody who's in like immersed in the railroad, we call the rail earth, railroad earth.
You said once, train spotting is where I go to get in touch with nature. Watching trains is a place where I find zen.
That's true, yes. I would compare it to maybe how some men go fishing. You know, it's not even about catching a fish. I guess it's just about the journey of being out there in the wilderness and having the patience to maybe wait on a good one and maybe sometimes catch just a bunch of little ones, you know, and waiting on trains the same way. You know, usually we're waiting around to see possibly our own stuff, also the writings and monikers of others. So, you know, you can wait around all day and see a bunch of good stuff.
Where do you go in this
anywhere
city?
Anywhere you can see trains rolling by is a good place. But I always I like visiting all the yards. You know, you can go anywhere from Hapeville, Union City, Forest Park to Tilford Yard, Inman Yard. I usually just roll by yards. Ever since 9/11, it's been a little more strict. Homeland Security is no joke, you know. But if you can make yourself familiar enough, they know who you are. They won't even stop after a while. And there's plenty of people, rail fanners. There's guys who don't do anything but just take pictures of the engines. But you, after all the years of watching trains, I've run into every type of guy. But there's people in Georgia who've been doing this stuff 30, 40 years.
Whether they're painting graffiti or not.
They're not even painting graffiti. They just sit out there with their walkie-talkies and their monitors and stuff. They tell me what engines are coming. You know, they're called rail fanners.
Yeah, yeah.
Guys look a little bit like yourself.
Old.
Old guys, yeah. But they're interesting. They always have a grip of knowledge, you know? So, and the older I get, you know, the more so I don't even necessarily care about the graffiti stuff. As far as I like love running into these guys and hearing what they got to say and seeing the old engines, and they know all the model numbers and the history behind some of these things. Sometimes they know that they've been repainted and redone and they want to see it come through and take a epic picture of it.
So what were you, when you first started writing on freight trains here?
Yes.
What were you writing?
Name-wise?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I started writing, I think the first ones I was doing, like, busy pieces. I was writing Dax, D-A-K-S. I also wrote Rifsky. I wrote Prone, Macer, T-R. I could probably go on and on. I had a lot of names back then. I didn't really, being as young as I wasn't catching on to a lot of the things that I know now.
Were you, everything done in spray paint?
No, not at first. Oh, well, you know, even till this day, I've been pretty open to using anything. I'll scratch, you know, my name with a rock into something when I was younger. But, you know, as I got older, started getting nicer markers, started making my own markers, finding out what inks were, you know, flowed better, were a little more permanent. Spray paint's always been awesome, you know, especially Rust-Oleum was always our favorite.
So you go out, let's say, you identify a place where you know you're going to find a car from a train.
Yes.
Are there certain kinds of cars that are better for writing on than others?
These days, yeah, people have been very picky. People want to go for the flat ones and the box cars, you know, certain ones, you know, like the refrigerator cars are very flat and big and usually white. And almost every person who started writing, especially as far as recently, they go after those cars with a vengeance. And now they're starting to go over each other and fight over them. They look like subways from New York now when you see them roll by, which I used to not see anything written on cars except for maybe some monikers or you get lucky to see some cool graffiti. And these days, every single one of those cars, but me and some of my friends always kind of liked all of them. We thought all of them were a go. And, you know, we weren't scared of any ridges or one being too rusty or too round or whatever, you know, whatever the complaints these guys
have.
So
what supplies are you taking with you when you go to
the
train?
When I do that, I'll only bring spray paint and preferably Rust-Oleum enamel. It lasts forever.
I want to read you something that was written about your work.
All right.
A critic, an art critic. And we're going to talk about this transition that you made to becoming
a good criticism.
An artist. But, yeah, well, we all love critics,
yeah,
don't we,
yeah,
Dax?
Yeah.
Dr. Dak's pop-infused, overinflated, candy-colored letters convey remarkable energy and ebullient goodwill. Dr. Dax also has a tendency to animate and infuse his text with personality, capping his letters with a layer of white frosting or giving each letter its own textural signature, making his words and letters lively and fun. Now, that's a
well, I like
good
that.
Review.
Where'd you read that at?
I read that in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Good Lord, I
art
like
critic
that.
That's a good one. Felicia Feaster wrote that about your work.
I need to memorize that for when people ask me about my work.
So, but here's the point. She clearly thinks your work is fun. Is that what you want it to be?
Definitely. I always when I was younger, you know, I grew up, and not necessarily because I was into punk rock and, like, you know, skinhead culture and any of that, but just even on everybody I went to school with at the time, I don't know what it was, but something about the turn of from the 80s to the 90s, everybody was really into violence. You know, the answer for everything was just to fight it out, one-on-one fights. People started getting into guns. And we kind of thought that was what, you know, as kids, we thought, that's just life, what it was. I don't know what it was, but we had just a lot of violence back in Atlanta back in those days. Everybody was fighting about everything. And I started kind of getting bummed out about it, you know, when everybody else was kind of getting off on it. And then also Atlanta's always been very brick and very dim. I just knew the brighter the colors I used, the more you just stuck out
on. What are your favorite colors?
I love all the pastel colors. I love putting pastel colors, Easter egg type stuff, and I love outlining it in black. Yeah. That's my favorite part of doing what I do is just putting that black outline. And I don't always do that, but that's been pretty much my color theory. But, you know, growing up in Florida and going to Miami, to South Beach, even when it was abandoned as a kid for hurricane season, I always used to just get lit up on all the colors on the Art Deco hotels. And then even when I moved to Atlanta, we used to go in the candy aisle at the Kroger at the grocery store and just I'd get light up, you know, lit up and see all the bubble gum and all the candy wrappers. And I think just being a child, that just instantly was like, I'm going to try to make that my look.
What is the Dungeon family?
The Dungeon family was a bunch of guys from the SWATs, which is Southwest Atlanta, East Point to College Park area. They'd all came together, a bunch of creative, all young black men who came together because they were all had the same vision of doing great music. And then in that, you know, it branched out into being different divisions of that even, but it ended up being Outkast. And Goody Mob. And Cool Breeze. Witch Doctor, Big Rube, you know, other people who are in the music industry, some people who aren't in the music industry, but definitely just a big group of guys who.
And you got to know these guys before they became.
Yeah.
Big stars.
I mean, you know, all of us were young, so wasn't nobody was any more important or creative than anyone else. And then as time went on, you know, some guys definitely hit the jackpot, which being Outkast would probably be the number one guys. The world really took to them, and that really blew everybody's mind because not a lot of hip-hop artists were emerging out of Atlanta. There was some guys, local heroes like Kilo and Raheem the Dream, and people loved that here. And I thought that was just the music was being played everywhere, but I go visit my mom in Florida, people didn't have a clue what that was. You know?
How old were you at this point? So what year are we talking about?
We're talking years. About 1987, 88, 89.
All right, so you were still young.
Very young,
and they
yeah.
were too.
Well, yeah, and I met them at a time when, you know, Atlanta at least started having its own sound and music. We were listening to people, and we might have thought that was the whole world, but the radio was pretty much just being biased, I guess, or being cool and letting that local stuff, you know, letting it ride. And then Outkast and all that emerged out of that. Ichiban Records and So Def and all this, you know, like a lot of bass music, which was a Miami sound. And I guess people, mainly being Organized Noise and Outkast, wanted to start having, you know, creating the Atlanta sound.
Yeah, you said in an interview once, people who made music here had it in their minds they would never blow up. They're like, you can't be an Atlanta artist and blow up. But it was Dallas Austin who came along and changed all that. Who was Dallas Austin?
Dallas Austin is the guy who started TLC. He had Rowdy Records. He moved on to produce for Michael Jackson, Madonna, Stevie Nicks. I mean, you name it. Lenny Kravitz, probably one of the biggest super producers ever out of Atlanta.
Right.
You know, somebody, I guess, who in the past would be kind of like Quincy Jones or something.
So, Dex, here you are going to Grady High School.
Yes.
And, I mean, you're a white guy. And I'm assuming, like most environments, white kids stuck with white kids, black kids with black kids,
yeah.
Unfortunate as it might be. And here you are hanging around with all these young black guys who are going to be hip-hop artists. How did that happen?
I think maybe coming from Florida, I didn't really I didn't fall into place with anybody. So when I came here, I either didn't fall into place with anybody or I fell into place with everybody. You know, I kind of just went back and forth with people just not having it with me. And then some people just loved me to death. It's right when I got here, being black and white. So I guess being different, I got to like fall in with the right people. God just put me right in a place. And then meeting the Dungeon family was just great for me because a lot of people I went to school with, everybody wanted to play sports. My older brother played sports. My dad wanted me to play sports. It was very about being into sports here, and I was very not into that.
Yeah.
So meeting those guys, they didn't necessarily – they liked to watch sports, but they weren't into playing sports as much. They were trying to be creative, and, you know, some of them were also graffiti writers, Organized Noise, Ray Murray, Sleepy Brown, and Rico Wade. Those guys were into graffiti. Ray Murray was one of the first graffiti writers in Atlanta. So when I met those guys, that was naturally just like, oh, wow, you were the first. And they didn't even care about that stuff anymore. They were so into music,
they
trying to make
music.
But, you know, just a little bit of knowledge I can get, just like being an archaeologist, I was just digging, like, when did you do that? Who'd you do that with? Who was this guy? Just trying to figure out what I could figure out. So that kind of struck up a relationship between me and some of those guys, too.
They took you on the ride with them as
That's
they
right.
became famous. You want to put on your headphones for a minute?
Sure.
So Jenny's going to play you a little something.
All right.
When it's out two or three movies, but everything's great like 9:15. It's back to the time machine, I believe. Back to the rhyming, back to the spit. Back to the my head, kick, slam. Y'all nigga dare to think that was it. We everywhere. Like the air you breathe. Got up stuck like Chuck in the web. We weave like a lace front.
That's right.
Who is that?
That's a Big Boy solo album, Big Boy from Outkast. He did a song with Too Short, which is a legendary Oakland hip-hop artist and pioneer. And, of course, the father of funk,
George Clinton's in there,
that's
too.
That's right. Yeah, and that was interesting because we got to hang out with those guys.
So that's the sound, that's the audio portion
yes.
of one of the videos.
Yeah,
the
video that I
produced.
Directed, one of many videos I directed. That one I did I did with Zach Wolf, which is a photographer from here. And we got to go with Big Boy to Savannah, and I believe we did 3 or 4 videos all in one go, which I don't know if anybody's ever quite did anything like that. But since I was taking a nice lick at directing videos at the time, which I'm into doing anything visual, Big Boy asked me to go to Savannah and just start knocking out videos. And so we got a humongous budget and went down there and partied for a couple weeks and flew people like Too Short and George Clinton out. Got to just, I don't know, that was a really good experience at the time.
Especially
because I wasn't a seasoned director at the time. It was just, I've always taken photographs, always documented, and not necessarily with a focus, but I think just having a natural talent for visual, I just instantly folded right into that. Fine. And Big Boy believed in me, and I'm glad he did. Appreciate you, Big Boy.
So let's talk a little bit about transitions in your life. We talked about the fact that the initial graffiti writers absolutely rejected the idea of being considered artists, and you did too.
Yes, at first.
At first.
Yeah, maybe that's, in the modern world of things how they are, that's just maybe a natural progression too, to, you know, start off as vandalism and, that being my canvas. And what a better place to, like, develop. You know, it's almost like the boot camp of art school.
How did that happen for you, though?
I was already getting offered money for what I did, and I didn't really care about it because I had money. You know, I hustled. I don't want to get too specific, but I hustled. I dabbled in the hustling world, the criminal life. So I was not really interested in selling it, but it kind of crossed my mind that maybe this is something I should start figuring out, how I can make money off of this, so when I can leave this other criminal life, I can go into this art world, you know? And I've learned that would be harder than I thought, too, because you can't just walk into galleries looking the way I do and talking the way I talk. But I think something about the mystique of me being a graffiti writer and it coming around to be a something that people pump money and corporate pumps money into now. I had just once again in my life, I was like the Forrest Gump of this. I just always the right place, the right time, transitioning at the right time. So it was just a natural progression just to start selling it as, you know, art. And,
so now instead of writing on trains,
yes,
you're writing on canvases.
Yes.
Right? And you're still doing essentially...
And large walls and murals.
But essentially still doing graffiti.
Yes. Yeah. I kind of switched it up, you know. My style isn't just the normal, what I would paint illegally to what I would paint on canvases. I paint a lot more. It's not so ego-driven with just being my name. That's more about portraying a positive message or some sort of message or trying to get across something that I'm feeling at the time or just what or something that I feel like people can words they can live by, you know.
My own Bible verses. What's an example of trying to get a positive message across in one of your pieces?
You know, I try to tell people to park friendly and to be friendly and, you know, just some good life lesson stuff, you know, almost like great toast are made. You know, just giving people almost like a blessing, almost.
If I were to walk into a gallery and see one of your canvases,
yes.
And really fell in love with it, what's a general price range that I would have to pay for your work these days?
Man, the galleries, those guys go high. You know, if you go to Mason Fine Art, talk to Mark, who's the owner of it, probably about $8,000.
Okay.
On the low end.
So you're doing well.
Sometimes, you know, it's a roller coaster ride. Yeah. If I'm hanging out with Mark, I'm doing good. But, you know, when I'm out here on my own.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Mark because Mark actually did a show and he assembled 9 of you, as I recall.
Yeah.
I think, didn't he actually go to Home Depot or something and buy fake brick walls?
Yeah.
For some...
Man, I had to give it to that guy. You know, that the stuff that he's doing is pretty bold, especially in the South. That's not something that anybody's taken on. Galleries, you know, they love us. I talk to gallery owners. They think I'm great, but they don't want to necessarily, you know, have my art in their gallery. But they'll come up to me and give me my respect. But Mark came to us, and he bought, like you said, the fake brick walls, and he called the show Inside Out. He wanted to, like, really bring raw street graffiti. He's really opened a lot of minds, a lot of people who would probably still to this day frown on graffiti and anything that portrays it. But he really, you know, he's definitely stamped our passport in that world, a couple of us.
You alluded to, and I assume you don't much want to talk about your criminal past, because you do have one.
I don't mind talking about it.
Well, I mean, you were a drug dealer at one point, right?
You could say something like that, yeah?
Yeah.
I guess
I read, in fact, somewhere that I did read an interview where you sort of railed against the way in which big corporate cartels were taking over the sweet little mom and pop drug pushers in the neighborhood. And I thought that was pretty strange.
I think that just comes along with this town becoming a real city. You know, it was only a matter of time before they wouldn't let us do it ourselves.
Yeah, but you don't want to talk about, but it's, you understand it's hard for an audience listening to you to think about your being critical of the big drug operation stomping on the little mom and pop drug dealer.
I guess because I was directly affected by it.
But here's why. That's
probably the same as the guy who used to own Ace Hardware or whatever who goes to Home Depot.
But here's the reason I even bring it up at all. You talked about God put you in the right place.
Yes.
And you'd have gone through some really difficult times. You have found yourself in a different place at your age, 30-something.
39 years old.
And you're now working as a commercial artist. You've changed.
Thank God.
That's my question. How big a role does God play in your life?
Man, I mean, I wouldn't consider myself religious. I don't go to church. My parents never pumped any sort of stuff into my head. But I think, you know, getting out of trouble so many times, big trouble, and also being in situations where I could have died or, you know, had to talk myself out of dying or whatever. I just started believing there must be a higher power. So I realized that anything I want, I can just sit there and just think about it all the time and I can bring it into my life
and
make it happen. And it's exciting every time. It's like magic.
Is the magic that a Felicia Feaster sees in your graffiti inspired by a higher power?
Yeah, I guess it is because you know, I've always tried to exude positive and, like, powerful things. And, you know, as my manager, Sarah, or my intern here, Bradley, can tell you, I have a negative overtone. I can have a short temper. But, you know, I'm trying to grow out of that, always growing further and further away from that and trying to exude, you know, electrical, bright colors and just, you know, trying to have some sort of, like, powerful, positive impact over the world, you know. And even if I can't let it affect myself, I try to make everybody else smile, even when I can't.
Well, Dax, I have to tell you, you've made me smile a lot.
You made me smile today.
In this conversation, and I'm really grateful to you for coming in and talking to me on Two-Way Street. I want to look for your trains now. Are there a lot of them out there?
I'd like to think there still are. You know, I did them right. I respected the load limits and the numbers and stuff, so my stuff usually
runs a little longer than other people's, but you know, some of it might have just fallen off the train by now. But yeah, they still get caught. I see people putting them up on Instagram, and kids can be kind of geeked up since I've retired from that, and to see that I still have all this stuff that I've left the world. I could die today.
Dax, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dax Redneck is one of the most celebrated graffiti writers in the Southeast. If you want to take a look at some of his work, you can see it on our website and on our Facebook page. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Our senior producer is the unusually unabashed Jenny Amond. Our producer is the singularly scintillating Lisa Clark. Our engineer is the splendidly sincere Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening today. See you again next week for another Two-Way Street.